China warning that the U.S. will pay the price if the House Speaker visits Taiwan, and that hours after Washington said Nancy Pelosi has the right to visit the island. Russia expresses full solidarity with China, denouncing a potential visit by Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan as pure provocation. And Iran saying it has injected gas into hundreds of new advanced centrifuges in response to the latest round of U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Beijing and Washington remain at loggerheads over a visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan.
The U.S. side will bear the responsibility and pay the price for undermining China's sovereign security interests. I think it is very clear to the world that it is the United States that is taking provocative action, causing tensions in the Taiwan Strait, and the United States should and must take full responsibility for this escalation.
The latest warning came hours after Washington said that Pelosi is entitled to travel to Taiwan. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said that Washington sees no reason for Beijing to turn the visit into a crisis. The U.S. House Speaker is on a tour of East Asia and has just landed in Taipei. We just covered live images a few minutes ago. She is the highest-ranking American official to visit Taiwan. And Beijing considers Taiwan part of its own territory, and as opposed to Washington's growing engagement with Taipei, Russia has already reacted, calling Pelosi's visit to Taiwan pure provocation. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has stressed Russia's solidarity with China. So Pelosi is visiting Taiwan now. Iran saying it has started injecting hexafluoride gas into hundreds of new advanced centrifuges in response to the latest U.S. sanctions targeting the country's trade. Foreign Minister Amin Abdullahian says that the U.S. cannot get concessions from Iran while resorting to such measures. He also urged Washington to stop its excessive demands. Amin Abdullahian noted Tehran is serious to continue talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA. He stressed, however, that his country is seeking a good, strong, and durable agreement. The top diplomat added Tehran won't sit idle by if Washington keeps following its current approach. On Monday, the U.S. blacklisted six companies claiming they helped Iran export petrochemicals to East Asia. Later in the day, Iran began injecting gas into hundreds of centrifuges, including advanced IR-1 and IR-6 machines. The Iranian capital city, Tehran, has played a host to the 7th Islamic Human Rights Awards. The event tries to honor those who have contributed to human rights around the world. Our correspondent was also there.
The top prize of the Islamic Human Rights Awards goes to Shirin Abu Akla. The former Al Jazeera journalist was shot dead by Israeli forces back in May while reporting Tel Aviv's atrocities against Palestinians. Her name echoed here in the 7th edition of Islamic Human Rights and Dignity Awards. Shirin was awarded for her vital role in shining a light on the Palestinian cause in her on-the-scene reports from the occupied territories.
Shirin was killed by an Israeli bullet. There's also criticism directed at the U.S. Israel is pushing the United States to avoid introducing the Tel Aviv regime as the killer of Shirin Abu Akleh. But we at Al Jazeera will continue our investigation of the case to bring her assassin to justice.
Another winner of the Islamic Human Rights Awards was Mandla Mandela, the grandson of former South African President Nelson Mandela. Mandla, who is now serving as a member of South Africa's National Assembly, won the award for his active role in opposing the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
The Palestinian issue is of greatest importance to us, as we have seen the atrocities that are being meted out against defenseless children, women who are languishing in Israeli jails, as well as Palestinians in general. And we continue to expose the apartheid regime of Israel as carrying out crimes against humanity and genocide against the Palestinian people.
organized by the Iranian Judiciary's Human Rights Committee. The event was held on the occasion of the 32nd anniversary of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam. In 1990, member states of the Organization of the Islamic Conference assembled in Cairo and laid out a new human rights charter that sought to ensure man's freedom and right to dignity in accordance with Islamic laws.
Activists here say the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights states that every human being, regardless of race and religion, has the right to a dignified life, something which they say the West has so far not lived up to.
Observers say the West, and on top of them the U.S., maintains a selective approach toward human rights to an extent that it violates even its own principles of human rights.
For example, you see that in Canada, how they are treating the indigenous people. They are their own people, and their rights are violated. Or in the United States, so you see that how they are treating with the blacks. So they are also, again, their own people. So for them, it doesn't matter whether it is Islamic human rights or the international human rights or the Western human rights principles.
The imposition of sanctions as a punishing leverage is another example cited by participants here as a blatant violation of human rights by Washington.
The sanctions that have been imposed on the Islamic Republic are secondary sanctions imposed by the United States, not by the United Nations. South Africa itself does not observe these sanctions. We don't recognize them.
Here, participants say the Islamic narrative of human rights is not meant to be a counterpoint to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it seeks to safeguard the rights of Muslims against any misuse by countries such as the U.S., which looks at the issue through the lens of its political interests. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The U.S. says it has killed al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in the course of an air raid in the heart of the African capital, Kabul. Zawahiri's house was hit by two missiles fired from a drone over the weekend. President Biden has justified a killing of the leader of al-Qaeda. It's a terrorist group some American leaders acknowledge that the CIA had created. Meantime, the Taliban government has condemned the deadly drone strike in Afghanistan as a violation of international principles and the 2020 agreement on the American troop withdrawal. The U.S. has carried out several drone strikes since pulling its forces out of the war-torn country. Zawahiri took over al-Qaeda after its original leader, Osama bin Laden, was killed by U.S. special forces in Pakistan in 2011. Now, political commentator Scott Bennett joined us a short while ago and said that the U.S. intends to divert attention from its wrong foreign policies by announcing it's killed the al-Qaeda leader.
I think this is something that the United States is doing because of the desperation that it finds itself in on the chessboard of international operations, diplomacy, and military operations. But false flag events are meant to distract the population away from considering and analyzing other potentially damaging political events such as China, such as the war in Ukraine, such as the $60 billion that Biden has been giving to Ukraine and a massive money laundering operation, such as the war crimes that the U.S. has been aiding and abetting, both in the murder of Ukrainian prisoners of war with the HIMAR missile systems, as well as the biological and chemical weapons factory that the U.S. was developing in Ukraine from 2005 to 2019, essentially, to develop biological chemical weapons targeting the Slavic Russian DNA. All of that paperwork is coming out. So, notoriously, the West gets very nervous when it begins to get scrutinized and examined from international theaters. Of course, the West is the originator of the destabilization and the endless terror wars.
Okay, let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Russia expressing readiness for talks with the U.S. on a new nuclear arms control pact, but it says the basis should be mutual respect and mutual concerns. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says such negotiations are long overdue. He blamed the U.S. for not showing interest in negotiations despite an early request by his country. The remarks came a day after U.S. President Biden called on Russia to hold talks on a deal to replace the New START treaty after its expiry in 2026. The two countries had agreed to extend the existing treaty for another 5 years, just days before it was due to expire in February 2021. The New START, signed in 2010, limits each country to deploy not more than 1,515 nuclear warheads, 700 missiles, and bombers. It also allows sweeping on-site inspections. More than 7 years of war in Yemen have left the country devastated. A vast majority of the population lives below the poverty line, making the country the poorest in the region. Multiple attempts to broker a lasting peace agreement have all failed. Now the people fear more hostilities as the latest truce between the Ansar movement and the Saud-led coalition expires on Tuesday.
The war in Yemen has killed thousands of people and left a large portion of the population on the verge of starvation. But 2 months ago, a spark of hope was reignited among the Yemenis. The Saudi-backed coalition and the Ansarullah resistance movement announced an extension to the 2-month truce, which was agreed upon in April. But now, the same hope has transformed into fear and anxiety for the civilians as the war-ravaged country awaits two scenarios: a new cycle of war or an extended cessation of conflict. The United Nations-sponsored truce has been the longest respite Yemen has seen during the war. But even though the truce lasted despite multiple violations from the Saudi side, there have been no reports of an extension. As the expiration approached, the UN ramped up its efforts to renew the agreement, which it says has resulted in improved humanitarian conditions and has led to a significant decrease in civilian casualties. The truce brought immense relief to civilians, but its true potential regarding effectiveness and longevity remain under question. One issue that persists is Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement being dissatisfied with its implementation, saying the Saudi-led coalition has not fulfilled its obligations. Experts have also criticized the truce for failing to address the main and underlying issues behind the war.
Well, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudis, who did block shipments and engaged in a couple of skirmishes, but it was still much better than the previous state of affairs. And that currently it seems to be expiring without serious action to make it permanent, presumably mainly because, the Saudis are not willing to let go of this stranglehold they've got right now on Yemen, and they're not willing to let go of their hopes for establishing a puppet regime and getting control of this geostrategically crucial area. And the West has apparently decided to let them.
Now, one of the key unresolved issues is the port city of Aden, which is still under siege, blocking the flow of humanitarian goods to the rest of Yemen. The other not so often cited issue is the role of the UAE and Israel in the Yemen conflict. The UAE is using Yemen's Socotra Island that overlooks Bab al-Mandeb Strait for joint spying operations with the Tel Aviv regime. And this is besides the U.S. attempts to get more Yemeni territories under its control in clear violation of that country's sovereignty.
Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen with the objective of installing a Riyadh-friendly regime and crushing the Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement. But while the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its goals, the war has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The ongoing war on Yemeni people has also sparked global outrage over grim violations of human rights. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has voiced concern over the torture and ill-treatment of Yemenis by the United Arab Emirates, armed forces, state security agencies, and on-state armed groups. Earlier this year, the UN expressed concern regarding the civilian casualties in Yemen. Many rights organizations have also condemned the acts of aggression against the Yemenis, especially children and women, and denounced the continued international silence on the crimes. But the June ceasefire, especially its extension in April, raised the prospects of peace in a country that has only faced destruction and gloom over the past years.
Well, it would be nice if a habit of peace had been established so that the hot war doesn't break out again right away. But again, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudi side. And the fact that they haven't been able to extend it is a bad sign. It suggests that the Saudis are unwilling to essentially admit that they made a mistake when they entered this war, and that they can't gain control over Yemen. And that admission would require a big change in policy, and right now they're not under enough pressure to do it. The oil prices have gone up. The Saudis are doing okay financially. They apparently are under no pressure whatsoever from the Biden administration to roll back or extend the truce or negotiate a lasting peace. So I don't see any indication, unfortunately, that the truce will continue.
Yemeni officials have, however, expressed their doubt over a third extension of the ceasefire. They say the UN has failed to bring the much-needed breathing room for civilians. Another matter which seems to be behind the Yemenis' doubt is the Saudi-led coalition refusing to fully commit to the terms of the truce, including halting its attacks.
UN experts blast Israel for harassing human rights defenders and humanitarian workers in Palestinian villages in the occupied West Bank. In a joint statement, four special rapporteurs call on the regime to stop harassing those who are seeking to support and protect people in the Masafer Yatta area. They say Israel is acting with impunity and often detains or confiscates cars and documents of rights defenders on the ground of entering restricted site. The statement says that residents also continue to be threatened by the risk of mass forced evictions and arbitrary displacement. Masafer Yatta is home to 19 Palestinian villages, but the area was declared a military zone by Israel in the 1980s. The regime frequently evicts Palestinians and rights activists from there, citing different pretexts. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in the previous episode, you heard the account of Imam Khomeini's proposal for marriage to Khadija Saqafi, whose father was one of the renowned ulema in Tehran. If you remember, it was said that there was opposition towards this marriage, as the girl was from a rich family and might not tolerate tough conditions of a clergyman like young Sayyid Ruhullah, who had little material facilities and was seriously engaged in a struggle against the puppet tyrannical regime. Today you will hear more on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Lady Khadija Saqafi's father raised several conditions for her daughter's marriage with Imam Khomeini. Firstly, he had not married before. Secondly, he had no children. Thirdly, he should be rich enough to administer an ordinary family. Fourthly, he should not transfer his wife's house to Khomeini. Mr. Lavasani informed Sayyid Ruhullah of the conditions, and the latter accepted all of them. Thus, Khadija's father took a handwritten promise from Imam Khomeini not to change the daughter's residence. The young couple resided in a small house in Tehran. They stayed in this house for a few months as Sayyid Ruhullah decided to go to Qom to attend the courses in the seminary of that city. Lady Khadija Saqafi relates the story as follows. A few months had passed since our marriage. It was the Nowruz of 1309. The house rent had expired and spring was near. The classes were going to begin in Qom. The groom, this diligent student, was very enthusiastic. He was just thinking of Qom. In other words, he was preparing me to leave for Qom. He was eager to go while I was not. He would insist and I would keep silent. I knew that there was no escape and we should go, but I could not give up soon. It was hard for him to stay, while for me it seemed impossible to leave, as I didn't like Qom for living with a person whom I had not got used to yet. I was very scared. Imam Khomeini's wife continues her account on leaving Tehran for Qom. I had accepted to live with Mr. Ruhullah. Now, against my will, I had to leave Tehran, my parents, sisters, and brothers, who all live there. I had to leave everyone for a place where I would be lonely. But accompanying the husband is a principle, and I had to live up to the determinations which God has set and I have accepted. I should accept them with satisfaction, as it determines my happiness in this world and the hereafter. The Quran says, it may be that you dislike something while it is good for you, and it may be that you love something while it is bad for you. Therefore, young Khadija set out for Qom although she knew that life in that city would surely include many problems. Lady Masume, peace upon her, was her only companion in that lonely city, as she says, till the end of staying in Qom. Whenever I was upset or sad, I would go to Lady Masume's shrine. I would cry there and clean my eyes. Then I would return home with a happy heart and joyous face. After all, I had made the decision when I wanted to come to Qom, as I had no one other than Lady Masume to confine with. Imam Khomeini and his wife left Tehran for Qom on Farvardin 14th, 1309, corresponding with April 3rd, 1930. Lady Khadija Saghafi relates the account. Finally, we were to set out. The truck was hired, and it was the first time that I was traveling in such a vehicle. My dowry was loaded on the truck, and we were placed on narrow seats. Some others also got on the truck. I was crying right till Hassanabad. After nearly 3 hours of crying, Mr. Ruhullah said, "That's enough. Have patience." I was silent and choked my feeling, which caused me sore throat. The young couple rented a small house after 1 week of staying at a friend's home. Khadija soon made friend with the wife of the owner. She says, "In my first letter to my mother, I wrote that, in spite of being lonely, I have found a good friend, and Mr. Ruhullah has rented a nice house which has 14 fruits. Do not be sad for me. Imam Khomeini's first child, Mustafa, was born in this house, only to decrease his mother's loneliness." Imam Khomeini's third residence was located in an old neighborhood in Qom. The rental was hard for the couple to pay, as young Ruhullah wouldn't like to receive the stipend from the sources of emulation and had made himself content with the income that he would get sporadically from his paternal real estate in Khomein. Lady Khadija Saghafi relates the story. "The rental was a little high for my husband. We led a life of a seminary student in or a small house. Mr. Ruhullah had a small real estate in Khomein, which we tried to make ourselves content with, that not to show our need. He would never accept any stipend and was very magnanimous. However, the revenues of the real estate were not regular for us to rely on. We had to live in tough conditions for 6 months so that the wheat in Khomein was sold to get our share to pay the debts. Yet, Mr. Ruhullah preferred hunger for his child rather than accepting the stipend, although other ulama and students would receive it. He was very knowledgeable, and the sources of emulation were ready to pay him other amounts of money, but he would never accept. He let us taste hardships to taste freedom. I tolerated patiently so that he remains Haj Agha Ruhullah. At last, I brought those hardships to their knees." Dear listeners, the revenues of Imam Khomeini would receive little of his father's real estates and farms in Khomein. But this does not mean that he had a poor family. His father was a very generous man who used to spend great parts of his revenues to the poor and the needy. The family would feed hundreds of people during wars and famines. He had a lot of properties, farms and gardens in the villages around Khomein, but he used to spend the revenues mostly for charity and religious schools. Lady Khadija Saghafi recommends the young generation, try to live simply. Try to be content. Try not to be indebted to anyone for a better and wealthier life. If a person wants to live with dignity and pride, he or she should heed lest the luxuries of this world may not deceive him or her.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then send our condolences to our 12th and living Imam, Al-Hujja Ajalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, and to each and every one of you as we gather on this evening and on these nights to commemorate the tragedy that befell upon the family of Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wa Alihi Wasallam.
And when you look at Imam Al-Hussein in Karbala, that when Hur did what Hur did, and when Hur came, the compassion of the Imam was overflowing at that time. May we receive that kind of compassion from the Imam of our time, huh? Because Hur is that example. I think Hur has that relatability to each and every one of us, because none of us are perfect. None of us are perfect. But Hur had something in his heart. You know what Hur had in his heart? Hur had the love of Fatima al-Zahra in his heart. Hur understood the position of Fatima al-Zahra. You know, it is said that Hur was the commander of an army or a battalion of 1,000 men. And the job of this man was simple. The job of Hur was simple, to intercept the Imam and to bring him back towards Kufa. It is said that when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was leaving Makkah, he stopped at numerous places until he got to a place called Sharaf. When he got to Sharaf, the Imam did something which was unique. He told every single youth and every single companion to fill their watering skin. You don't need to travel with that much water when you know you will soon have water again. But the Imam knew something was coming. The Imam alayhi salam, then as they left Sharaf, they reached a place called Dhu Husam. And before they reached Dhu Husam, they saw a battalion of 1,000 men approaching them. Imam camped in Dhu Husam, and when Hur and his battalion and his army came to Dhu Husam, the Imam alayhi salam saw thirst in the faces of Hur and his companions. He saw that not only were they thirsty, even their animals were thirsty. The Imam gave instruction to all of his companions and family that give them this water that we have. We say, salam to you, O Hussein. Salam to you. There will come a time very soon when Hussein, your children will cry, Al-Atash. Al-Atash, but they will not give you any water. Have they forgotten 2 weeks prior, Hussein, that you gave them water? There's a companion of Hur who says that I was the last one to come. And when I came, I said, I was so thirsty that Hussein bin Ali came himself to quench my thirst. He says, Hussein told me, get off of your camel, sit your camel down. And Hussein used his own hands to quench my thirst. Imam alayhi salam in Dhu Husam prayed Dhuhr. He gathered his companions for Dhuhr Salah. At the time of Dhuhr, he looks towards Hur and he says to Hur, O Hur, aturidu an tusalli bi ashabika? He says, Hur, do you want to pray with yourselves and we will pray with ourselves? Hur says, La bal tusalli anta wa tusalli bi salatik. He says, no, we will pray behind you, O Hussein. Hur knew. We get examples of this. Hur knew who Hussein was. They prayed their dhuhr salah. Imam went back to his camp. It came back at the time of Asr salah. They prayed together again. At this time, Imam alayhi salam took out bags of letters from Kufa. He says that you were the ones who invited me. If you do not want me, tell me, I will go back. Hur says, we will not allow you to go back. The Imam alayhi salam gets up. He gets back and tells his caravan that we are leaving. As the caravan begins to leave, Hur comes and blocks the way of the Imam. According to some narrations, Hur not only blocks the way of the Imam, he grabs the reins of the horses of the Imam. This is an act of aggression, huh? He grabs the horses of the Imam. The Imam alayhi salam says, Thakalatka ummuk ma turid. He says, your mother will weep for you, O Hur. What do you want? You know the jawab of Hur was what? Hur was a bahadur, huh? Hur was a brave man. Hur says, O Hussein, if any man in Arabia had said anything about my mother, I would say the same back to them. But what can I say about your mother? But what can I say about your mother, Fatima? He says, I hold her in the highest of regards, O Hussein. And then again we get a glimpse into the heart of Hur. Hur says to Hussein alayhi salam that I have not been instructed to fight you. He says, write a letter to Yazid. Write a letter to Ubaidullah if you want. He says, find a situation, but get me out of this situation, Hussein. This was the position of Hur. We come to the day of Ashura. When the fighting begins, you know, Hur never assumed that it would get to this stage. He always thought that some agreement would be reached. But when the drum beats on the day of Ashura began to ring and the arrows began to fly, Hur comes to Umar ibn Sa'ad and says, Aslahak Allah. He says, may God have mercy on you. Anta muqatil hadha rajul. Do you really intend on fighting Hussein? Umar ibn Sa'ad replies, Wallah. He says, hey, by God, I do. I will behead Hussein at this time. The conscience of Hur began to take over. The narrations say that Hur slowly gets onto his horse. He begins to slowly ride his horse towards the camp of Imam al-Hussein, a companion of Hur by the name of Muhajir. He says, O Hur, where are you going? O Hur, are you attacking Hussein? But Hur did not reply. Instead, Hur was trembling his entire body. Muhajir says, O Hur, if they had asked me who the bravest warrior in Kufa was, I would give them your name. But today I see you in a condition that I have not seen you before. You know the jawab of Hur. My brothers and sisters, we cry for Hur. We want to be like Hur. But look at what Hur says. Hur says, Inni wallah akhiru nafsi bainal jannati wan nar. Wallah la akhtaru ala jannati shay'a. He says, I find myself between heaven and hell. I find myself between heaven and hell, and by God, I will not select hell for anyone. Hur rides towards the Imam. The narrations say that when Hur rides, he places his hands clasped over his head, a sign that he was coming in surrender. And as he was riding his horse, he kept reciting, Atubu ilallah. Oh Allah, forgive me. Oh Allah, it is I who have put your awliya in this situation. It is I who have put the son of the daughter of Rasulullah in this situation. Again, Hur remembers Fatima and the position he places his family in. When Hur finally comes to Imam al-Hussein, what does he say? He says, may God allow me to be sacrificed for you, Yabna Rasulullah. He says, I am the one who prevented you from leaving. He says, I am the one who troubled you on your way. I am the one who forced you to stop. It is I who have put you in this situation, O Hussein. It is my fault. Do you think that Allah will forgive me? Do you think that Allah will allow me to overlook this transgression of mine? Wa inni qad ji'tuka ta'iban mimma kana minni ila rabbi. I have come to ask for your forgiveness, O Hussein. Wa Husayna, you know, whatever mistake Hur had made, whatever decisions Hur had made, he has now come to the khaymah of the one who is the most generous, the son of the most generous, the grandson of the most generous. Husayn welcomes Hur. Ahlan wa sahlan ya Hur. Come, O Hur. We have been waiting for you, O Hur. And then Hur immediately asks, O Hussein, I am ready to go and fight. I am ready to go and sacrifice. It is said, goes and fights. He fights bravely. Hur was a warrior. But how much can one man fight? Eventually, Hur falls. It is some riwayats say he was hit on his skull and it began to bleed. He fell from his horse. The companions bring him back towards Imam al-Hussein. Imam al-Hussein looks at Hur and he says, Antal Hur, kama sammatka ummuk, hurrun fid dunya wal. He says, indeed, Hur, you are just like how your mother has named you. You are free in this world and in Akhirah.
I swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In Britain, the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has won the backing of former Tory leadership rival Tom Togganhat. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled, Tom Togganhat Backs Liz Truss in Race for Number 10. Please stay with us for more of Aubrey Allegretti's article. In Britain, the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has won the backing of former Tory leadership rival Tom Toggenhat. In a major boost for the Foreign Secretary's campaign, Tom Toggenhat wrote in the Times that her plans for vast tax cuts are founded on true conservative principles. The chairman of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee also criticised Rishi Sunak's fiscal policy, saying it is not right that the tax burden should be rising when people are heading into winter with dread. His endorsement is important as he is popular among Conservative Party members and a senior figure in the One Nation group of centrist Tory MPs. It is another blow to Rishi Sunak after the Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, also came out in support of Liz Truss. Earlier, Rishi Sunak admitted a video of him as a youngster saying he had no working class friends was silly, as he defended holding off on tax cuts and claimed Liz Truss's plans would fuel an inflation sugar rush. The Tory leadership contender, who is trailing in the race to replace Boris Johnson, also insisted during an interview with Andrew Neil that he would ensure some asylum seekers were removed to Rwanda, even if it was only several hundred, as thousands more would be deterred. Rishi Sunak faced a tough grilling from the Channel 4 presenter Andrew Neil in the interview on Friday night that was dodged by his rival Liz Truss. Asked by Andrew Neil if there was not something unsavoury about the son of successful middle-class migrants prepared to turn away asylum seekers with a valid claim, he replied defiantly, "No." Though Rishi Sunak admitted only several hundred migrants may be removed under the plan that will cost millions of pounds, he said many thousands would be deterred from trying to cross the channel to claim asylum in the United Kingdom. Among the questions put to him was whether he was embarrassed by a clip aired on the BBC when Rishi Sunak was in his early 20s. It showed the now Tory leadership contender being interviewed as part of a programme on class. "I have friends who are aristocrats. I have friends who are upper class. I have friends who are working class. Well, not working class," said Sunak in the 2001 video clip. Video footage was lashed upon in the race to replace Boris Johnson when it resurfaced several weeks ago, with rivals scornful and suggesting it showed the wealthy Tory MP would not be able to relate to those struggling during the cost of living crisis. Rishi Sunak addressed the video when pressed about whether he was out of touch by Andrew Neil. Sunak said, "We all say silly things when we're students," he admitted. "I grew up working in my mum's pharmacy, and you don't end up doing that unless you interact with lots of people. I spent my time making sure we served our community. My parents worked incredibly hard to provide opportunities for me, and that's ultimately why I want to be Prime Minister, because this country allowed my family to provide a better opportunity and future for me." Rishi Sunak, who several opinion polls of Tory members have found is trailing behind Liz Truss in the leadership contest, was also tackled over his refusal to cut taxes and an alleged U-turn over cutting VAT on energy bills. Sunak had argued against the tax-cutting question in February when he was Chancellor, telling the House of Commons the policy would disproportionately benefit wealthier households. On Friday, 29th of July, he admitted it was a blunt instrument, but said it was one of few levers that politicians could pull quickly. He said the apparent vault face was absolutely not a case of poor judgment initially, and claimed Liz Truss's tax cuts, £30 billion to be funded by borrowing, would put fuel on the fire of already spiraling inflation. Rishi Sunak said the move would be a sugar rush that would also push up interest rates and make worse the economic difficulties that many will face this winter. Despite being invited for a similar grilling by Andrew Neil, Liz Truss followed the lead of Boris Johnson at the last general election and refused to appear in the interview with Andrew Neil. At the end of Friday's programme, Andrew Neil said she declined our invitation. Her choice, of course, that invitation still remains open.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. Fortunately, Mr. Mohseni, the head of the judiciary, is a faithful revolutionary person. The first point is with regards to the document on fundamental transformation that he talked about. The document on transformation is one of the most progressive documents for change. First, it was prepared, later it was revised during the time of Mr. Raisi. Important points were added and it was completed in that revision. So this document should be acted upon. The esteemed head of the judiciary is committed and he follows up on things. But matters must be followed up on at different levels. Judges, staff and managers must follow up on matters too. But based on the reports that I have received, some are not doing completely the things that one thinks should be done in this area. According to this document, a workforce should be trained. As has been frequently said, personnel need to be trained. Action should be taken in accordance with this document. That is, the judiciary must not be passive in the face of rumours, talk, opposition to it, and the like. There is a straight path in front of it, and it should follow and move along this path with strength. The judiciary should not be influenced by rumours and whether some people like what it has done and some people dislike it. This is the first recommendation.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و